This is Law and Disorder.
Today we're joined by the sister of a man who's on Georgia death row. He's facing imminent executions, and yet the court has not heard compelling evidence of his innocence.
Listen to this show because there's something you can do now, immediately, to save this man's life.
Also joining us today is Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, to give us the latest in the war on drugs. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Since 1973, more than 120 people have been released from death row due to evidence of their wrongful convictions. Today, we're going to talk about the case of Troy Anthony Davis. Troy has been on death row in Georgia for more than 15 years for the murder of a white police officer, Mark Allen McPhail, at a Burger King in Savannah, Georgia. There was no physical evidence against Troy Davis, and the weapon used in the crime was never found. The case against him consisted entirely of witness testimony, which contained inconsistencies even at the time of trial. Since then, every single one of those witnesses except two of the state's non-police witnesses from trial have recanted or contradicted their testimony. Many of these witnesses have stated in sworn affidavits that they were pressured or coerced by police into testifying or signing statements against Troy Davis. With us is Martina Correa, sister of Troy Davis. Welcome, Martina, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us in what must be a really difficult time. Just recently, the Supreme Court denied cert in your brother's case, which means they denied the opportunity for his case to be heard in front of the Supreme Court. Can you tell us a little bit about what is at issue in your brother's case and why you wanted to take it up to the Supreme Court?
Since probably 1997, we've been fighting a procedural defaulted error where something was filed too late on Troy's behalf. The courts have just been rubber stamping it. They actually have not ever heard Troy's information, and it was really amazing because someone asked the district attorney in Savannah, and he made the comment that Troy has went through all the courts and exhausted, you know, his appeals, wherein Troy has never actually been back to court since his habeas hearing that was actually held in the prison, and they wouldn't even allow him to call in witnesses at that time. So there was never a chance for Troy to have this information heard. And as we began getting the recantations, one beginning at trial, what they were just saying was that, well, we'll just go with whatever the lower court said. And so nobody's actually heard this in court. Nobody's actually had witnesses and juries.
Martina, take a step back and tell us about what happened and how he ended up on death row.
Well, Troy, in 1989, Troy was actually downtown. Some friends that came pick him up, and he went to play pool downtown near the bridge in Savannah where the Burger King and the Greyhound bus station was. And there was a gentleman in there named Sylvester Coles who was also playing pool. And he had been, you know, brandishing a gun all night and later earlier that day at a pool party. Well, anyway, a homeless man had went to the convenience store next to the pool hall, purchased some beer, and I guess Sylvester just wanted to intimidate the guy, so he was, like, asking him for some beer. The man refused. That was Larry Young. And then he started following the guy up the street, and, you know, Troy and some other guys, you know, leave him alone, you know, just come on back in and play pool, you know, calm down. Well, Sylvester didn't want to have anything to do with that, and he was upset that this guy refused to give him beer. So he followed him up to the Burger King parking lot. Troy and a 16-year-old came outside the pool hall and proceeded behind them to tell him, leave the guy alone. This time, Sylvester Coles and Larry Young were in the Burger King parking lot, and Sylvester Coles was pistol-whipping Larry Young. Troy ran across the street with the other 16-year-old to try to intercede and said, you know, leave him alone, you know, it's not worth it. Well, Sylvester Coles turns his gun on my brother and said, you know, get out of here, nigger, you don't know me, I'll shoot you. Well, Troy and the 16-year-old left, but then what took place was the off-duty police officer, Mark McPhail, was coming out because he heard it was a disturbance in the parking lot. He had a bulletproof vest, but he had his arm raised. And when his arm was raised, he had the nightstick in his hand and telling the person in the parking lot to stop. Larry Young was on the ground by this time bleeding, and Sylvester Coles fired at the police officer, hitting him under the arm. And then when he was laying on the ground, walked up to him and supposedly shot him in the face and took off. Well, Sylvester Coles went, took his guns, hid them in an empty abandoned building, where there was witnesses that testified they saw him change his clothes and then later sent two girls up to the parking lot to see if a police officer had been killed. But at that point, nobody knew who was shot and what because it was a very dark parking lot. And then Troy and this other gentleman, Daryl Collins, had already left the scene, and so they didn't know what was going on, and they actually thought Sylvester might have been shooting towards them because they were already back down by the pool hall. And so the next thing we know, 2 days later, Sylvester Coles went up to, or the next day, he went to the police department, and he asked for total immunity, and he pointed the finger at Troy. They had no description of Troy. They didn't even have a police picture of Troy, so the only picture they got of Troy was when they went to my mother's home and got the picture of Troy. But up until that point, all the witnesses that were in the parking lot described the shooter as Sylvester and specifically said that he was left-handed and Troy is right-handed. And so by that time, what happened was they start putting the witnesses in the room with Sylvester Coles and saying, no, this is not the person. This other person that Sylvester is telling you is the person. And they start changing their testimonies to fit Troy because the police were threatening them, including Larry Young. And one of the things that one of the attorneys had told us later was that he doesn't think that they maliciously went after Troy, but they had no evidence, they had no clues, and a police officer was dead. And then when Sylvester Coles walks in and he hands them Troy on a platter, they went with it and he ran. But
so the murder suspect, the primary murder suspect, according to other testimonies, fingered your brother.
Yes, he was the one, and he got total immunity. He was the only one that even testified at trial that he had a gun and that he threw his guns away and he didn't know where they were. They never did any gunpowder residue, any ballistic testing or anything on him. Troy came up negative for gunpowder residue, but Sylvester Coles pointed a finger at Troy, and they ran with it.
So what happened at trial?
At trial, our family wasn't even allowed to come in because one of the things that they do down here, which I'm sure they do a lot of other places, is to make it look like Troy had no supporters. We weren't allowed to come in. They told us that we were going to be called as witnesses. So we were on the witness list, and we didn't even know that. And we had no knowledge of the crime, what happened, who was there, but that was a way to keep our family out. All the witnesses had to be sequestered, but we couldn't be in the witness room with the rest of the witnesses. We sat on a stone bench outside the courtroom, and the other family came and all passed us all the time with armed guards and everything, and they treated us like crap. But the courtroom was pretty much separated, black and white. All the white people that came in, sat on one side behind the victim's family, and the people that we could get the call from work and stuff to come and try to go in there and tell us what was happening with Troy. Every time they would go in and they'd take notes, the guards would escort them out, so Troy really didn't have any support in the courtroom. The only time we were allowed in the courtroom was to beg for his life.
So you didn't even see what happened during trial?
No.
But you heard about the witnesses, yeah?
Yeah. And Daryl Collins, Dee, the 16-year-old, he was the only one that was brave enough to stand up and say, no, I never told you Troy did this.
Well, this is what Daryl Collins, I want to read an excerpt from his affidavit. Daryl Dee Collins said, After a couple of hours of the detectives yelling at me and threatening me, I finally broke down and told them what they wanted to hear. They would tell me things that they said happened, and I would repeat whatever they said. It is time that I told the truth about what happened that night, and what is written here is the truth. I am not proud for lying at Troy's trial, but the police had me so messed up that I felt that's all I could do, or else I would go to jail.
Yes. And he was 16 at the time, and his parents weren't there. There were no lawyers. Nothing was there with him when they were intimidating him.
We're speaking with Martina Correa, whose brother, Troy Davis, is serving time on death row and is facing imminent execution. I mean, I have in my hand 21 different affidavits recanting testimony that was given at trial or identifying this other person, Sylvester, or I guess he goes by the nickname Red, yes, as the shooter.
Yes.
Has any of this been introduced at trial?
No. The only one was D.D. Collins. At trial, he would not lie on Troy. And what was amazing, there was another gentleman named Lamont Holmes. Him and Jeffrey Sapp, they pretty much got to say the same thing. Troy rode around on a bicycle and told him he shot the police officer and then went home. Well, Jeffrey Sapp, of course, you can't say he was mad at Troy for a fight Troy got into with one of his friends. But Lamont Holmes, they were the only two that came to the preliminary hearing. And only witnesses came to the preliminary hearing. We weren't, and so it was really amazing. We thought they were there in support of Troy, but they had pending cases at the time. But it was really amazing because Lamont Holmes, we could not believe that he went in and said what he said. But we later found out he had a pending case in Florida because he came to my home and told my mother that he couldn't sleep. So what he decided to do was he was not going to come to trial because he said he couldn't lie on Troy. And they tried to find him, and he wouldn't show up. Well, when he didn't come to trial to recant his testimony at trial, then all the prosecutor had to do was read his original statement from the preliminary hearing, and there was no cross-examination. So, you know, we had witnesses that felt like, well, I won't show up, and then it'll be all right. But that wasn't the situation. We had other witnesses throughout the city who say they went to the district attorney's office to tell them that no, Troy was not the person, and a district attorney would tell them they didn't need their statements, they had enough information. And we didn't find out about these people till later, and that's why all these other people came forward, because they said that they went to the police and nobody wanted to hear what they had to say.
If you go on the amnesty.org website, there's a report, Where is the Justice for Me? The Case of Troy Davis Facing Execution in Georgia. This was a report that was released on February 1, 2007. You can read there excerpts from affidavits that are recanting testimony or statements given in the Troy Davis case, and I want to share with our listeners a little bit of that. Monty Holmes says, I told them, the police, I didn't know anything about who shot the officer, but they kept questioning me. I was real young at that time, and here they were questioning me about the murder of a police officer like I was in trouble or something. I was scared. It seemed like they wouldn't stop questioning me until I told them what they wanted to hear. So I did. I signed a statement saying that Troy told me he shot the cop. Another one, Jeffrey Sapp, says, I got tired of them, the police, harassing me, and they made it clear that the only way they would leave me alone is if I told them what they wanted to hear. I told them that Troy told me he did it, but it wasn't true. Troy never said that or anything like it. When it came time for Troy's trial, the police made it clear to me that I needed to stick to my original statement. That is, what they wanted me to say. I didn't want to have any more problems with the cops, so I testified against Troy. This one, in particular, shocks a lot of people from Antoine Williams. He says, they asked me, the police, to describe the shooter and what he looked like and what he was wearing. I kept telling them I didn't know. It was dark, my windows were tinted, and I was scared. It all happened so fast. Even today, I know that I could not honestly identify who shot the officer that night. I couldn't then, either. After the officers talked to me, they gave me a statement and told me to sign it. I signed it. I did not read it because I cannot read. And that statement implicated Troy Davis.
Right. And it goes on and on and on like that many times. And some of the things that happens is that, you know, with the resource center, you have one lawyer, when the resource center was defunded, trying to handle 80, 90 death penalty cases. Those are on appeal. I mean, it's really ridiculous. But at trial, I mean, even in a newspaper, they made a comment that the who's who of criminals were being paraded to testify against Troy. They tried to demonize Troy, dehumanize Troy. They said he dropped out of school. You know, Troy started going to night school because I had a sister who was paralyzed from the neck down. Troy went to night school and graduated from high school so that he could stay home in a day where my mother worked, and he catheterized my sister, did her hair, took her to a doctor's appointment, physical therapy, everything. If it wasn't for Troy, my sister would have never have walked again because the doctor said she would never walk. But, I mean, they tried to turn everything. Troy was actually getting ready to go to Marine Corps. We had pictures of him in his high school diploma, but every time there was Father's Day, Mother's Day, they would put Troy's picture in the paper. Cop killer takes children away from father. I mean, just digging the nails into the coffin. They gave him a change of venue. It was one of the biggest cases ever in Savannah, and they refused to give him a change of venue. All of the people on the jury had heard about the case. Everybody had. Some witnesses, not some jurors were stricken, particularly this one Caucasian female, because she said she would never believe Troy Davis was guilty, and they asked her why. And she said because Dorothy Farrell was one of the witnesses, and Dorothy Farrell was a career criminal who had robbed her store several times. And she was one of the key eyewitnesses that at the Georgia Supreme Court, they said, we want to know, was this woman lying? Did the jury hear that she called Troy's lawyer and said she was lying? And the state prosecutor said, yes, the court reporter must have been mistaken about the jury wasn't in there. The court reporter had to make a big mistake. Dorothy Farrell was telling the truth. Dorothy Farrell's mother died and something else happened. And 2 weeks after the Georgia Supreme Court ruled against Troy 5-4, Dorothy Farrell completely recanted her testimony, and they would not go back on a motion to readdress Troy's thing at the Georgia Supreme Court, and so they just kept pushing it.
I do want listeners to know that there have been 21 separate affidavits filed that either recant testimony, and in many cases they allege police coercion, like we just read, or they implicate another suspect, the Sylvester Red. And Troy Davis has never once had a hearing in federal court on the reliability of the witness testimony used against him at trial, where he could introduce these 21 different affidavits. Can you tell us why that is?
They just wouldn't do it. I mean, most of those judges are elected and appointed, and even in the Georgia Supreme Court, our family was allowed to go, but Troy wasn't there. It was amazing because the Chief Justice at the time, an African-American man, the lawyer only had 20 minutes. It's like the lawyer had 15, 20 minutes and a bell rang. But before Troy's lawyer could even finish what he was doing, the Chief Justice got up and he said he had to go to a speaking engagement. He would listen to the rest of it on tape. That's just the type of court it was. The Chief Justice said, we're arguing, can you, you know, listen to my brother's life or death situation? And he got up and said he had an appointment because he was speaking at some university. He didn't even stay in the courtroom. That's how bad these judges are down here, and they could care less, and they really promote the death penalty. But the thing about it is, the state prosecutor, the lawyers can say something, and the state prosecutor say, well, that must be a mistake. How can a court reporter forget that the jury was not in the room, or the court reporter makes such a blatant mistake? But that was the type of thing that they would say, and say, well, you know, he had his time in court, and Dorothy Farrell hasn't come forward. And then when she came forward and they asked them to readdress the issue, they refused. They say, just send it to the next court, because he should have tried to prove this at trial. But every time they deny Troy, it doesn't say the lawyers against so many of the state. It says Troy Davis, you know, the state versus Troy Davis. And when they deny, they send a denial to Troy. And it's like, Mr. Davis should have brought this up before. Well, how can Mr. Davis bring anything up when he's in prison and he's trying very hard to bring this stuff up? And the thing about it, they won't even address it.
And that's one of the things on appeal that we are facing in death penalty cases nowadays. Troy Davis is caught up, along with many others, in a trap set by Congress over 10 years ago when it withdrew funding from post-conviction defender organizations in 1995 and passed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which people also know as ADEPA. That was President Bill Clinton who signed that in April 1996. And basically, ADIPA requires federal courts to show greater deference to the decision of state courts. So you can only get relief if you're up on appeal if the decision of a state court resulted in a decision that is a very high standard, basically contrary to or involved in an unreasonable application of clearly established law. It just really shut off a lot of avenues for people who are scheduled for execution or who are on death row to have things like this heard, that there are 21 people now who say, Troy did not do this, I lied. Many of them saying the same person, one of the witnesses, one of the only witnesses left who didn't recant his testimony, is the person who did kill that police officer that night.
And also to note that this person has been in trouble with the law many times and has never done any jail time, any prison time, and is a big drug dealer and things in town and constantly intimidates people. And he has threatened me on several occasions, and as recently as 2 weeks ago, he walked up to me into a store and told me that I need to keep my mouth shut. But if you're so sure that my brother is guilty, why are you still threatening me?
Martina, what can people do now? The Supreme Court has denied his case, and my understanding is that means an execution date will be scheduled relatively soon. Is that right?
Yes.
And what can people do to help?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we need mass media. We need stories. We need letters, and not just the standard letter that's on the website, but we need letters, personal letters going to each individual parole board members, but we need to get thousands of letters for people who are in the Georgia area for the clemency hearing. We need to have as many people there as possible. But I think that the way that we are going to save Troy, and not only save Troy, but make a precedence about what's happening. See, Georgia has been able to lay under the radar because one thing is that nobody has ever been able to interview a death row inmate here in Georgia. And Troy is not the only person here in Georgia that has cases like this. And I think that if we can put pressure on the Department of Corrections to get an interview with Troy, that would be such a massive type of thing that would help Troy. But they say death row inmates in Georgia are not to be seen or heard because they want to stay under the radar what they're doing in Georgia. But we need people to call. If you can call the parole board, anything you can do.
Martina, I want to let folks know what they can do. Go to amnestyusa.org /abolish, or just the Amnesty International website. We'll also put everything up on lawanddisorder.org. Now, we're asking people to write or contact the Georgia Parole Board. They're also the Clemency Board.
Yes.
And use their own words to seek clemency for Troy Davis. If possible, write a separate appeal to each of the individual board members, but if you can only pick one, the chairperson is the way to go. And remember this, in the case of Troy Davis, there was no physical evidence against him. The weapon used in the crime was never found. The case against him consisted entirely of witness testimony. All but three of the state's non-police witnesses have recanted their testimony. Many of these witnesses have stated they were pressured or coerced by police. One of the three witnesses who has not recanted is Sylvester Red Coles, the principal alternative suspect, and nine individuals have signed affidavits implicating Sylvester Red Coles. So we're asking people to go to the website, lawanddisorder.org, write a letter if you can.
Yeah. And send and let Amnesty and other people know how many letters you're sending so we can keep a count. But also, one of the most important things is if you go on TroyAnthonyDavis.org, you'll see Troy's address. Please send Troy a card or letter of support and let him know that people are thinking about him and they are concerned about what's happening. But this is bigger than Troy, but we really, really have to expose Georgia to save Troy's life.
Martina Correa, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, and we are with you.
Thank you so much.
The factors that we just talked about in this case that lead to wrongful conviction are inadequate legal representation. It happens all the time. Police and prosecutorial misconduct, perjured testimony and mistaken eyewitness testimony, racial prejudice, jailhouse snitch testimony, suppression and misinterpretation of mitigating evidence, community and political pressure to solve a case, and it seems that they were all coming together in this case of Troy Davis. And so we're asking people to take a really hard look at this case and to think about the death penalty and to take action. Execution dates will be set fairly quickly, so please take action now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Nearly 2.1 million Americans are currently serving time in prison, the majority of them for nonviolent offenses. One out of every six of these inmates is in federal prison on marijuana-related charges. Astonishingly, according to the laws in 15 states, one can receive a life sentence for nonviolent marijuana infractions. Compare that to a national average sentence of 6 years for homicide. In large cities such as New York, law enforcement officers have markedly stepped up their efforts to target low-level drug offenders, mostly for marijuana. Watchdog organizations claim that this is also a means to build a database on inner-city youth. Data shared and networked globally by several multinational security agencies. In response to these sentencing disparities and the growing prison population, a drug policy reform movement is gaining momentum, says our next guest. Joining us now is Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance and the author of many books, including Policing the Globe, Criminalization and Crime Control in International Relations. Welcome, Ethan, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
And we wanted to get started by asking you what you think the situation is with respect to the heralding of the war on drugs years ago, and it was supposed to make things so much better. Where are we at now on it? What have been the consequences?
You know, it's interesting with the war on drugs. What's really happening now, I think, is two forces of great momentum are sort of moving forward in opposite directions. The first one is that the war on drugs is a prison industrial complex. It's become like a juggernaut, right? It's the private prison builders, it's the prison guards unions, it's the district attorneys running for office and appealing to people's fears and everything about that. There's this knee-jerk presumption in America that if we don't like it, let's make it a criminal law, let's lock people up. And the result of that has been that America ranks first in the world in incarceration rates. You know, United States, we have almost 5% of the world's population. We have almost 25% of the world's prison population, right? We're number one. The Russians keep trying to huff and puff and keep up with us. They can't do it. We are number one. If you look at the numbers, there were 500,000 people behind bars in 1980. Now, as a report came out yesterday, 2.25 million people. 2.25 million people. And of those, something like 25% are there simply for violating a drug law. Nothing else, just violating a drug law, growing it, smoking it, possessing it, selling it, buying it, what have you. I mean, that doesn't even count all the other people for drug-related offenses. So you have this sort of juggernaut where people keep sort of, you know, habitually introducing new criminal laws, new penalties, like we just can't help ourselves. It's by force of habit. On the other hand, what we've seen emerging in the last 10 or 15 years is an increasingly effective movement for ending the war on drugs, a drug policy reform movement. My organization, the Drug Policy Alliance, we're the leading organization in the country of people who believe that the war on drugs is doing more harm than good. You know, our supporters span the political spectrum from the right-wing libertarians, the William Buckleys and Milton Friedmans and a whole range of others, to the whole range of people in the middle and the left. It ranges the spectrum in terms of how people relate to drugs, people who love drugs, love smoking pot, love whatever, people who hate drugs and have seen the worst of drugs, people who don't give a damn about drugs but just don't like the drug war. And we become effective at running ballot initiatives around the country to appeal to public opinion and change the laws, and moving state legislatures, whether it's reforming the Rockefeller drug laws or laws around the country, about beginning to engage the media, first the internet media, some of the elite media, and reaching on that way. So there's these two forces coming up. I think our movement for reform is gaining a lot of steam, but every time we think we're about to really clinch something, we see the old knee-jerk stuff come rearing up and smack us back down again.
I was going to say, you know, I've heard you before. You're a great speaker. I love listening to you. But, you know, I haven't really seen so much gain yet. I mean, even here in New York with the Rockefeller drug laws, we've had some gain, but in the end, we didn't get that much. So I you've been at it a long time. I don't know how optimistic I am.
I tell you, look, the fact of the matter is, one way we deal with this stuff is to put this movement in a broader historical context. I mean, I've been in this stuff for, you know, in various ways, 10, 15, 20 years, right? What I see is some people burning out and feeling, how can you ever win this thing? Don't you just want to give up, despair, what have you? Then there's this whole new generation of people coming up, the activists in their 20s coming into the drug policy reform movement are like nothing I've ever seen before. They don't know the defeats of the past. And so I look at the drug policy reform movement and I say that we are standing today in the year 2007 more or less where the gay rights movement was in the 60s, or civil rights was in the 30s or 40s, or women's rights was in the 1890s, or the movement to abolish slavery and the slave trade was in the 1820s or 30s. Right?
It was 9 out of 10 people were in favor of slavery in the 1820s and
1830s. I saw the movie about Wilbur Wilberforce, right. Amazing Grace. You see him, he's totally despondent as, you know, he's 20 years into it, everything's falling apart, and then things change. So what I realize, you have to take a multi-generational perspective on this thing. You realize that in every one of these cases, people saw the cause as quixotic, right? They saw it had no chance of winning. In every one of these cases, we were confronting powerful vested interests who appealed to people's fears about their women and children. In every one of these cases, foreign countries were moving ahead on reform faster than we were. In every one of these cases, simple kind of libertarian right-wing cost-benefit analysis generally favored reform as opposed to the vested interests wanting to keep the old thing in place. Now, if you look at the details, I'm in a position to connect the dots. I see Rockefeller reform. We got two little reforms in 2004-2005. We now have commitment from Spitzer. He pushed us back this year, although we hit him hard in some ways. I think we'll come back next year, and especially if the Democrats take the Senate, we're going to get major reform. The Assembly's already there, and Spitzer's made commitments. You look in California, we passed a ballot initiative, Prop 36, in the year 2000. It's now the biggest piece of sentencing reform since the repeal of alcohol prohibition. Almost 100,000 people who would have gone to jail or prison did not go and were diverted into drug treatment. It also saved taxpayers about $1 billion, even while doubling state funding for drug treatment. So that's a model. On the other hand, we go to Maryland where we get a bill, you know, a modest little mandatory minimum reform bill to just give, you know, parole to second-time drug offenders. We get it through the legislature and Governor O'Malley vetoes it. So yes, we move forward, we move back. Sometimes it feels like three steps forward, two steps back. Sometimes it's the other way around. But the broader thrust of it, I think, shows that momentum is gaining on our side.
You know, I'd like to think that, and I think those are really good gains. You know, one of my son's best friends was just arrested for marijuana. Okay. And you look at the statistics. 20 years ago, there were, what, 50,000 arrests a year? Now there's 500,000 arrests a year in New York City. So there's actually been a graph that's going straight up.
Well, I'll tell you, the marijuana thing is interesting because nationally speaking, right, there's 1.8 million people arrested for drugs last year. Of that, almost 800,000 was for marijuana alone. And of that, over 700,000, so 90% of all marijuana arrests, right, was for possession alone, oftentimes no more than a joint. What leads the country in marijuana arrests? New York City. New York City in Dinkins last year had 3,000 marijuana arrests.
I didn't mean arrests when I said it. I misspoke. Okay. It's 500,000 people were stopped, right?
But Giuliani in the year 2000 goes up to 60,000 marijuana arrests. Now under Bloomberg, it came down about half that. It's bounced back up. You know, there's a couple of colleagues, Deborah Small and Harry Levine, a professor at Queens College, who've been doing some research. Right. What they're finding out is that New York City is basically leading the country in marijuana arrests. So people should be careful. Don't smoke a joint in public.
It's amazing here.
But you know, I think that the reason for that may be that they just want to increase their police database on these young people that
they stop. That seems to be an important factor. I mean, Harry Levine, sociologist at Queens, has been interviewing people. He's finding there's lots of things. Part of it, of course, is that when crack cocaine or heroin were a big thing in the 80s and 90s, people kind of poo-pooed marijuana, including the cops. You almost laughed at if you brought in a marijuana case. As there's been a decline in at least the public crack markets, as the police have been successful in pushing it behind closed doors, marijuana becomes a visible thing. So when you're going down and you're pushing this broken windows policing as far as you can go, the marijuana one becomes a very, very easy thing to do. The other thing is, of course, it keeps cops busy. Yeah. Which is something that police leadership want to do. Another thing that Harry found out is that some of the cops go, you know, when you do a marijuana collar, he goes, they're basically not such bad people. And when you think of your choices, you want to do a drunk, you want to do a junkie, you want to do this or that, hey, busting somebody for marijuana and spending the next 3 or 4 hours racking up overtime while you sit with him and schmooze and you know he's going to walk home in 24
and
hours, 48
hours. Your
colleague
Pam Lichty said they don't throw up in the back seat.
Well, exactly. They don't throw up in the back seat. In fact, the cops even call him Harry's, this is Harry found this out, collars for dollars, right? It's how you build up overtime. So there's all sorts of incentives. I don't really know why Commissioner Kelly is so fixed on doing this because other people high up in the Bloomberg administration think this is ridiculous.
It is crazy.
And at least stop throwing people through the jail system. If you're going to give them a fine or a traffic ticket, okay, but clogging the system doesn't seem to make sense. They have some logic. And I think it also is about putting as many people as possible into the system, getting as many young people of color with their first nick with the criminal justice system. For many people, a marijuana arrest is the first time they've ever been arrested.
I was just going to ask you about a subject you touched on. How does racial bias play into all this?
Well, the amazing thing that, I mean, the really remarkable finding that Harry and Deborah came up with was finding that something like 2/3 of all the marijuana arrests in New York City are not for what I thought it was, which was smoking a joint in public or being hanging out with a bunch of kids who were once smoking. They're actually based from stop and frisks. And what you can see is as much
explain
racial,
what that is for
well, as much racial bias as you would have, right, in terms of the cops being disproportionately in minority neighborhoods, disproportionately looking at minority kids. Whereas if one of us, you know, older white people were smoking a joint, the cops almost look right through you. They don't even think to look. Most, not just cops, anybody. But the stop and frisk are when police basically stop people, oftentimes without probable cause or with some flimsy probable cause. They're much more likely to do that to young people of color, dramatically more likely. And what's happening is they're finding marijuana, you know, a joint, this or that, and that becomes the basis. So it's not even public view stuff. It's part of the highly aggressive policing strategy, which may have played a role in reducing crime, but which is clearly a case of overkill in so many regards, and I think this marijuana one's mostly one of the most evident.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance.
If our listeners want to get a hold of the Drug Policy Alliance, we'll put this up as a link to lawanddisorder.org. How do people reach you?
Well, the best way is just our website. It's drugpolicy.org. And I should make clear, we're working intensively in New York, not just on reforming the Rockefeller drug laws. We're going to be moving forward on trying to change city drug policies. You know, one of the nice things in New York right now is that the mayor, Bloomberg, and his health commissioner, Tom Friedman, have actually been very forward-thinking on the health aspect of this stuff. You know, when Bloomberg came out early on in his administration and said, needle exchange works, and I'm going to do it. And then when Tom Friedman, the health commissioner, personally went to Queens and said, you guys got junkies just like every other borough in New York. We're opening one here. When somebody, there's a wonderful woman, Dahlia Heller now, your namesake, Dahlia Heller, working in the health commissioner's office, who's used to run a needle exchange program. So there's some very good stuff. As unappealing and ugly as the intensive marijuana arrest strategy is, the public health thing, New York's really one of the leaders in the country, and I think can become more and more of a model here, depending upon what happens after Bloomberg and Friedman, of course. But we're working here, we're working around the country, and we're even active internationally. You know, every 10 years, the United Nations does a great big global review of drug policy. And just yesterday, they came out with their annual global drug report, trying to put a positive spin. So we're going to be engaged in the international process as well. In Congress, important to realize that the Democratic leadership there is very different than the Democratic leadership was in the 80s and 90s when it comes to the drug war. You know, the old lot who were basically competing with the Republicans to be tough on drugs. Now you got Nancy Pelosi and her sidekick George Miller from California. You got John Conyers, Bonnie Frank, Henry Waxman. In the Senate, Dick Durbin from Illinois, number two in the state Senate, he's the best ally we have for drug policy reform. So they're telling us, don't push us too hard till 2009. Don't make us vulnerable. We'll try to do a little something on reforming the mandatory minimum drug laws. We'll try to do something to allow.
I hope you're right on that. That's what they always tell me when I try and get them to do something Guantanamo or torture. They say, wait till 2009.
I mean, the truth is that the single most important thing, just speaking narrowly from my perspective, if the Democrats can consolidate their leadership role in Congress, there'll be room to run. These folks understand this issue and get this issue on a personal level. You know who's now chairing the House Appropriations Subcommittee with Oversight of Drug Control Agencies? Dennis Kucinich. I go to see him a few months ago. I start pitching him on drug policy reform. He goes, stop pitching me. I'm with you. Tell me what to do. The guy who's now chairing the House Subcommittee on Crime is Bobby Scott, black Democrat from Richmond, Virginia. No reason to be especially progressive. He's one of the best members of Congress when this issue comes up. So there's a different leadership group. In fact,
what are you
our
asking
allies,
them to do? What kind of things do you want?
Really three things. The first one is simply to try to move forward on incremental reforms that will not hurt, not put them politically at risk.
And that means, federal level. What
on the
that
federal
mean,
level. Right? That means getting rid of the crack powder, you know, bias in the federal drug laws where 5 grams of crack gets you the same 5 or 10 year penalty as 500 grams of powder. It means trying to get rid of some of the other mandatory minimums. It means doing sensible public health stuff. It means allowing drug treatment programs that work, not just that are abstinence or religious-based. It means doing innovative overdose prevention programs. It means no longer funding these paramilitary operations in Colombia that are not doing anything on a drug control perspective but empowering the wrong sorts of people. There's a range of small steps that they can actually do now that won't hurt them politically. Then the second thing we're asking them to do is to start putting the bigger issues out there. Like I said to Bobby Scott, why don't you do a congressional hearing on the issue of why does America need to lead the world on incarceration rates? Why don't you ask the health people, do a hearing on medical marijuana. Ask Dennis Kucinich, how about let's do a hearing about why should the DEA, the Federal Drug and Control Agency, have oversight of what drugs that doctors can prescribe in the privacy of their own offices? Putting some of these bigger questions out there, because if you think about it, there has not been a real honest, science-based hearing in Congress on drugs since the Jimmy Carter days. And the third thing we're asking them to do is to step back and look at where they want this thing to be going long term. What kind of world do we want our kids and grand, this multi-generational issue? Where do we want this thing to be? How much do we really want the criminal justice system involved in this at all? How much is appropriate? What are we afraid of? It's finding the ways to get them to sort of take off their hats, kick back, and be honest about where this goes, come to some private sense of understanding about the long-term future, and then begin to act incrementally in ways that keep that long-term vision in mind.
Ethan, how about you? Where do you see us going in the future, ideally?
Well, you know, Dahlia, I tell you, my sense is that I see myself as being in the first generation or first and a half generation of this multi-generational movement. I see us pursuing a two-track strategy of incremental reforms. Most of our resources go into reform Rockefeller drug laws, legalized needle exchange in New Jersey, overdose prevention here, reforming mandatory minimums, honest drug education, but always with this long-term vision. In terms of our stated objectives, with respect to marijuana, we're very clear. Take it out of the criminal justice system. 40% of all the drug arrests, make it legal, tax, control, and regulate it like booze, try to keep kids out of trouble. Or if we're worried about corporations dominating that, at least go as far as the Dutch have gone, where essentially the retail side is legalized and the wholesale side is still in this gray area. With respect to the other drugs, I think as a matter of simple civil liberties and human rights, I would eliminate the prohibition on personal possession of small amounts of any drug. That's ultimately the fuel that is driving this drug war. We have to stop the notion that we should be punished simply for what we put in our body if we don't hurt anybody else. That's our core principle. Don't punish people for what they put in their body if they don't hurt anybody else. And when it comes finally to all the drug markets and heroin, cocaine, we have a big debate. Some of my organization says let's legalize the whole shebang. Others say we can't go there. It's too scary. It's crazy. But we need that debate to be lively. We need it to be educated. And we need to find ways to slowly bring this illicit market above ground where it can be regulated. This is the thing. When people talk about the evolution from slavery to Jim Crow to the war on drugs is the new Jim Crow. There is nothing driving the incarceration of people, and especially people of color, and especially young people of color, and especially women in this country like this. If 20-odd percent of all men are behind bars for a drug law violation, it's 35 or 40% of all women. You know, the same disproportion between white and black. This is driving it. Politicians have played on people's fears. You go to black neighborhoods, and they're still freaked out about drugs, understandably. But somehow they born into the notion that oppression is the answer. But there's a pendulum shift going on. 15 years ago, Jesse Jackson and Charlie Rangel were my principal debating opponents. Now they're lining up to, you know, do greetings to our conferences and do robocalls for our ballot initiatives. And the younger black politicians are basically standing up and playing a leadership role. So we are seeing a change. It's slower in the South. It's slower in other parts of the country. But, I mean, we're not giving up. And even when it feels like it's two steps forward, three steps back, we know that next year it'll be the other way around and we keep moving forward.
We had Deborah Small on, executive director of Break the Chains, several weeks ago, and she talked about the A&E show intervention that takes people who are addicted to drugs and in a very destructive lifestyle, overtly treats the problem as a medical problem and not a criminal problem. But overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, all the participants in that show are white. Can you comment on this?
Well, you know, it's an interesting dilemma. About how you market this issue and put this issue out to maximize public sympathy. I remember there was one time an HBO special on prisoners in the war on drugs, and the producers got so caught up in the imagery of people behind bars, but oftentimes people who would look scary and black and dangerous, that I don't know what accomplished their objective. I remember Deborah Small, who has Break the Chains, used to be my policy director at Drug Policy Alliance, and we had this interesting dilemma some years back, right, which was we were going to do a television ad on the Rockefeller drug laws. 96% of all the people locked up on Rockefeller drug charges are black or brown.
Why don't you give us the last pieces as we close, Ethan, where people can go for information, what they can do.
Go to drugpolicy.org. We're one of the best sites out there. There's a whole range of other organizations as well. There's two organizations working. There's NORMAL, which many people know. There is a Marijuana Policy Project, which is involved in doing a lot of good work. There's Americans for Safe Access, which works specifically on medical marijuana. There's FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, working on that issue. There's a couple of organizations, one very good one working on psychedelics called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, which actually does some very good work. There's also going to be every 2 2 years is a remarkable gathering of people opposed to the war on drugs. This coming December, the first week in December, December 5th to 8th, in New Orleans, is the International Drug Policy Reform Conference. It's organized by my organization, Drug Policy Alliance, together with the ACLU, Marijuana Policy Project, Harm Reduction Coalition, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, that's Cops Against Prohibition, and the Marijuana Policy Project, or Students for Sensible Drug Policy. Be 1,000 people down there from around the world, activists, professionals, governments, government people, you name it. Anybody who comes to there, whether it's the first time they've been to this gathering or the 5th or 10th, comes away spun around, invigorated, and educated, and opened up, enlightened in ways they could not believe before they got there.
Well, it was amazing as usual whenever I hear you, so
well,
I really
you, Michael.
Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dahlia, Mike. Thanks a
right.
lot.
That was Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.